All right, thanks everyone. I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for having me and coming to the talk. Today I'm going to talk about something, given the title, it sounds a little bit strange, but I hope to at least somewhat motivate why I'm doing this. So for a very long time now, I've studied what happens when dark matter collects in compact stars. And the upshot is kind of that when dark matter collects in compact stars, the life cycle of these stars can be somewhat altered from what you naturally expect. So this is kind of a hammer I've had around for a while. And one nail that's kind of become apparent for this hammer over the last few years is that there's this strange idea called cosmological natural selection, where the idea is that you could somehow understand the parameters of your underlying theory as being driven or tuned towards producing lots of black holes in the late time limit of your universe, or actually in the present time limit of the universe in its current incarnation. But before I get started, I want to say that there are going to be anthropic arguments in this. A lot of times those are very controversial, and I think it's important to make a distinction between really good theories that lead to anthropic sort of conclusions, and this would be something like inflation or axion dark matter. So as soon as you know you have inflation, it becomes clear that there's a possibility that we're in a particular vacuum just because we inflated down to that vacuum. And if you found axion dark matter and it had a very small misalignment angle based on what you expected, you would also, have sort of an anthropic argument for why that happened, because if the misalignment angle of the axion was larger, there would be too much dark matter in our universe, and we would have recollapsed after inflation. In both of these cases, you started from very well-motivated theories, and you've reached anthropic conclusions. With what I'm going to be talking about today, there are all sorts of problems with anthropic conclusions, and you might suppose that there is a theory that gets around a lot of those problems, and that's what I'm going to be doing. So while on the one hand it's not going to be as well motivated from a bottom-up theoretical perspective, I think it's maybe worth considering, simply because with this work I've been doing with Tim Linden and Nirmal Raj, we came across a few ideas and measures which are a little bit different than what has appeared in the literature before. So even if these ideas don't directly bear fruit for cosmological natural selection, they still may be worth considering for application to other areas. And I should say, this is related to my work on compact stars and dark matter's effects on compact stars. And I'm doing other projects on this with Haipeng An. We're looking at whether you can get a baryonic feedback effect from dark matter creating supernovae inside dwarf galaxies. With James Unwin, we're looking at general models of heavy asymmetric dark matter. And with Adam Martin and Antonio Delgado, I'm looking at getting equations right for capture of dark matter when it's not in the optically thin limit. And I can talk about that a little bit later if you guys want. Okay, so getting started. We'll start with something that most people here are probably sick of. So naturalness, if all terms in your Lagrangian, naturalness supposes that all terms in your Lagrangian that preserve symmetries of your theory should have order one coefficients. Okay. You might contrast this with selection, where instead of assuming that there's some natural mechanistic explanation for your Lagrangian coefficients, instead you assume that some set of scalar VEVs or scalar fields with distributions spread across universes are somehow selected to give the observed universe. So the simplest example that probably people are fairly familiar with is in the case of the Higgs. You can say that there's a bit of a fine-tuning problem, because the mass term of the Higgs is not protected against quadratic corrections at one loop level. So if you don't have a theory that somehow cancels off these corrections to the Higgs mass, then as you consider a theory at higher and higher cutoff, it looks like the Higgs mass is more and more tuned. And so this sort of demands that there's some mechanistic theory that jumps in and gets rid of these quadratic divergences. But you can contrast that with the anthropic approach to this, where you just say, okay, if I had a Higgs mass or VEV that was much greater than the one observed, and not so much greater, then all of a sudden I would have no nuclei because the difference between the mass of the neutron and the proton would be greater than the binding energy of nucleons and nuclei. As you increase it more, you again still have no nuclei, but the lowest stable state is a delta particle with double charge, and so that's sort of the helium only universe. So this is work that Donahue and all et al. Did in '96, and I think is mostly what people think of when they think that the Higgs might be anthropically selected. But this immediately runs into a big problem, which is called the measure problem, or it goes by a lot of names, how you choose your priors. And this is that you can play ping pong with this. We're theorists, so we're very good at coming up with new parameters to solve the problems presented by old parameters. So Donahue's idea with Agrawal, Barr, and Seckel is that if the Higgs valve is heavier, there's no atoms. But you can immediately jump in and say, okay, well, what about a weakless universe? So the idea here, and this was something that Harnack, Cribbs, and Perez propounded in 2006. If you increase the Higgs valve to its natural mass Planck value, but then you decrease the technically natural UdS quark and electron Yukawa couplings to maintain the observed fermion masses, then it looks like you can get a universe where you still have atoms and stellar burning. And you know, isn't this universe far more likely? Because even if I vary over all the parameters, it seems like these parameters are natural, and so I should maybe have a wider prior, and you know, I should end up in this weakless universe. Then other authors come along and say, okay, well, actually, this universe doesn't quite look like ours. There's you know, an oxygen deficiency because you don't actually have a weak force to propagate neutrinos in supernova explosions, so you don't get the same sort of metallicity spread in your galactic halos, and so perhaps this actually doesn't work. And so then, you know, we could come along and say, well, why don't we just put in another weak scale boson or fifth force to permit supernova neutrino emission, and on we go. And there's a real problem. And I mean, the problem isn't just that, you know, you come up with a great argument and then someone, you know, says it's wrong. The problem is it becomes clear that it's really easy to fool yourself and not really know what's going on and have, you know, done a lot of investigation and maybe get nowhere. Okay, so we can catalog some sort of challenges for naturalness and selection. So one of the main challenges for naturalness is that the simplest natural theories are getting ruled out. MSSM, Technicolor have been proposed, but it's been 35 years and counting. However, that could just be a matter of human impatience. It doesn't necessarily indicate that there's anything wrong with those ideas. If you want a natural cosmological constant, it seems you have to revise gravity. And so at that level, it seems like if you want a really truly natural universe, you have a lot of work to do. The other thing is just generally, I mean, this idea of naturalness seems to, you know, jive with what we want as theorists in a theory, but nothing really mandates order one Lagrangian constants. Selection also has big challenges. Can this ever be verified? So we're in one selected universe. So it seems like it's a problem to try to figure out whether or not, you know, it actually occurred because we can't look at the other universes. The next thing is the measure problem I already talked about, which is which parameters are varied by how much and what is required for a universe like ours. So there's this ping pong back and forth between theorists, or sometimes theorists themselves ping pong with themselves. But I mean, selection, I mean, while it's, yeah. Question? Oh. So selection, while it's, you know, maybe leaves a bad taste in your mouth for these reasons, and it doesn't seem like normal science, a lot of the best theories we have seem like they're selecting initial conditions and vacua. So despite above these difficulties, you really should try to take selection seriously if you can. And with that, I move on to natural selection. So natural selection is actually, as far as I know, an idea that first came up in this brief musing Nambu had in a conference proceeding in 1985, where he said, if you look at the heavier generations of fermions, it seems like there's some sort of vestigial thing. Maybe the parameters of our theory were selected through a succession of universes or through a succession of parameters with some sort of repeated variation akin to biological evolution. And the idea here is pretty simple. If you start out with the universe and you create more universes, some of which are really good at producing new universes and some of which aren't so good at producing new universes, then if you randomly put us in a universe, then that universe should be pretty good at producing new universes because those will be the most plentiful kind of universes. And this has a direct analogy to biological natural selection. Yeah, so you can think of it as, you know, you start with this universe, you inflate, but the point is you have to vary your parameters each time, or else you don't get this effect. The other point, which I guess I'll just say now, is you have to vary your parameters a little bit, but not too much, because if you vary them too much, then you're just randomly walking through all these universes, and it doesn't seem like you'd end up in a universe that's necessarily good at producing.
Why does this solve the naturalness problem?
It doesn't. No, I'm not going to solve naturalness. I'm not going to solve everything. I'm just going to say that, you know, in this sort of framework, I'm going to propose that there are new things that can maybe help you understand what's going on in nature. I'm not claiming to solve everything.
By introducing a multiverse, why does that give me understanding?
I'll get there. So, I mean, in a sense, what's going to go on with cosmological natural selection is that we're going to cheat a little bit. Earlier I said the problem with selection is that you can't see all these other universes, but the point with cosmological natural selection is that if you assume that there are universes or that there are the, you know, beginnings of universes available to you observationally, then you can start to test your theory. And this is sort of what Smolin, I think, was driving at when he proposed this, is that you've now created a theory where conditions permit you to start evaluating how good the parameters are around you at producing new universes. And I'll talk briefly about how you could actually maybe realize that theory in terms of an explicit model very shortly, but that's the basic idea. So at a simple level, you know, you could assume that there's any sort of process that creates new universes. Smolin proposed that every black hole contains a new universe. While that idea is a little bit wild at first sight, these are the only known sites with greater than BVN density, so that seems like something that that would be the only candidate site we know of that a universe like ours could come from. And there's also some work, which I'll briefly review, by Brandon Berger, Mukhanov, Sornberger, Markov, and Frolov in 90 and 93, that shows that having a inflating space-time inside of a black hole is actually a reasonable possibility. So if you had this, if you had new universes created in black holes, and in each universe you've slightly varied the parameters of your theory, then you should expect, if you randomly selected a universe that we've ended up in, that your universe would be pretty good at producing black holes. Okay. Okay, so cosmological and natural selection, each time the universe, I'm just going to go through briefly some arguments Smolin made, and then I'm going to say sort of how we've tried to redo this, Tim Linden and Nirmal Raj and I, and the work we've been doing. So in cosmological natural selection, as originally proposed, each time the universe is produced, the parameters vary slightly, so you get a global drift towards optimizing black hole prediction. Something Smolin liked to point out is that you can vary each parameter in our universe, and if a variation creates more black holes, cosmological natural selection is falsified. So this immediately tells you that there's going to be a ping-pong problem here as well, because, you know, maybe you'll say, you know, this particular parameter falsifies the theory, but maybe, you know, some other thing, you know, can re-unfalsify it.
Are the parameters, should I think about them as being functions of some moduli?
Yes. So I'll get to that in like one slide. I'm going to say, you know, I think the explicit way to say this is that what you're saying is that you have a moduli space and you're varying your moduli field a little bit between each universe. Yeah.
But that's not necessarily the case. Right?
No. I mean, that's an assumption.
In most cases that you end up from, for example, the simple quantity theory, you end up from a 4D vacuum to a 2D vacuum. So
right.
It's not clear this is a good assumption at all.
No.
In fact, in most cases, but people have studied already, you get the tunneling. This makes an assumption about tunneling, right?
Mm-hmm.
You assume that tunnel much faster to a universe that's nearby.
Mm-hmm. Right? In parameter space, yeah.
In parameter space, which is not clear the case, because if you have the other fields,
mm-hmm.
like many fields, then there is no the what we call nearby in lifetime.
Right. Yeah, I think it's absolutely a very designed cosmology. If you assume a random parametric selection each time you make a new universe, then this is dead. That's true.
Is there a Lagrangian parameter associated with this?
I have a basic setup that I think can do it, and I'll get there in one slide. I think that's somewhat new, although I think it's, you know, not so revolutionary. It's kind of obvious how you would do it. But anyways.
And it's not also clear why black holes are relevant.
Black hole, I mean, the reason we're assuming black holes is because, you know, they're something we can see. I mean, it would probably be better, and I would have looked to do this, you know, this way if I could have, to think about something like just, you know, forming de Sitter patches in our universe faster than you naively expect, given Boltzmann production from, you know, the de Sitter vacuum we're actually in. Okay. Oh, okay. Yeah. Hopefully, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So the criteria is to maximize blood flow production. Would you favor all the mass scales to be here in Planck?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think there's a direct parallel to eternal inflation, where in an eternal inflation setup, you know, most of the universe is eternally inflating. And I think here, you really have to logically conclude that in most universes, you're just optimally producing black holes over and over again. So something like you have a really large primordial power spectrum, you pop out of inflation, you create tons of black holes, and so on and so on and so on. I think that would be the most likely universe, so I'll get into a second how you can define a measure maybe to explain our universe anyway. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, the other thing you already anticipate, large delta rho over rho would be.
Yeah, yeah, would be, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you will use arguments to exclude these possibilities?
I'm not going to exclude them. What I'm going to do is I'm going to apply Busso, Harnack, Cribbs, and Perez have a way to just define the entropy of a space-time volume, and I'm going to do a slight variation of that, and I'm going to argue that it's a reasonable measure for this sort of universe. Yeah, I'll get there pretty quickly, hopefully. All right, so. So just to really quickly go through Smolin's arguments, just so that they're clear, you have core collapse supernovae, which form black holes. This requires gas clouds that are greater than 20 solar masses. The core of the star fuses to iron and then collapses. This is just basic stellar mechanics. Shells explode, and the center becomes a black hole. So Smolin said this is a non-anthropic explanation of carbon because carbon, oxygen, and this is true, is what allows supermassive gas clouds to cool very efficiently. And so here you could say maybe we need carbon and oxygen in our universe not for life, but for forming black holes. And again, he says we can falsify this by the observation of strange quark stars, because if you can form strange quark stars, then it means that you could have parametrically selected your strange quark mass to be a bit heavier, so that you can no longer form strange quark stars, and then you can form more black holes. So this is. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, this is, yeah. Yeah, this is obviously, yeah. Yeah, this is incredibly complex. Like, you know, you could have figured out, you know, many simpler ways, I think, with one exception, which is that, you know, if you consider that you create a bunch of matter, and then you ask, how can I just jam that into a black hole, you do run into problems with your Eddington limit. So, you know, the more I give the.
But they know that work very well, right? Just imagine the universe that has high delta or the Planck scale is very low, so that the quantum gravity
stuff. Sure, to help you make more arguments. Vilenkin has a really good argument against this whole thing by saying, you know, if you just increase the cosmological constant a little bit, then in the far future of the universe, you'll produce tons more black holes than you would with a lower cosmological constant.
Yeah, so why is there anything that would favor this scenario with a more easy way for the black holes?
Yeah, it's basically that, you know, in a universe that's totally optimized for producing black holes, you don't have free entropy for things like us, and you, yeah.
So
in the. I'll get there. I think there's a reasonable way to measure this. Okay, these are good questions. So really quickly, I'm going to go through how you might explicitly find a model of cosmological natural selection. So you really need two things. You need black hole interiors to have a de Sitter or inflating spacetime, and you need the parameters of your underlying theory moduli fields to vary a small amount in each inflating spacetime. So there are these limiting curvature hypotheses that were presented in the early 90s that showed that if you just assume that GR has a maximum curvature, so this little L could be the Planck length in the simplest scenario, although in our scenario, we're going to want it to be a bit larger than the Planck length. This would be the simplest classical GR prescription, which solves the Penrose-Hawking singularity problem that your manifold is geodesically incomplete in classical GR. You just assume that there's actually a maximum curvature, so your manifold sort of by hand becomes geodesically complete. You can construct classical GR transitions to inflating spacetime when you reach your sort of maximum curvature inside of a black hole, and this was shown in 1990. They kind of do that by hand by saying that the by patching together an analytic solution that does it. But you can show more generally.
Yeah.
L is the maximum curvature permitted for GR in this hypothesis. It could be. It's not really a quantum gravity scale because you're treating everything classically. Nothing here is quantum, and you're just. Mm-hmm.
So it's the Planck length.
In their papers, it's the Planck length.
So supposedly the curvature is above at this point, and I'm not going to worry about
it. Yeah, that's basically it. Yeah, just suppose curvature can only get so great, and that length is set by little l. The natural thing is to assume it's the Planck length, but you can assume it's larger than that. Or show that when a finite number of invariants take on limiting values, any solution of Einstein's fields equation will asymptote to de Sitter, and they showed that you get this broader class of solutions that does this. So due to this limiting curvature constraint, collapse in the black hole interior halts at a radius which scales with the mass of the black hole to the 1/3. This tells you that in this sort of a scenario, for a fixed black hole mass, you sort of produce a fixed amount of de Sitter. You produce an amount of de Sitter patch that scales linearly with the mass of the black hole scales linearly with the volume of the de Sitter patch created. So this tells you that the size of your black hole maybe doesn't matter so much, but this can lead to an inflating spacetime where L equals your Hubble constant in the inflating spacetime. Yeah.
You have to presume that you have to find a regular classical solution of Einstein's vacuum field equation.
Yeah. So they do have a classic GR solution to Einstein's field equations that does this. Yeah. What's that?
What is this solution? Schwarzschild solution is not regular.
Mm-hmm. It gets a little bit complicated, but there are these Israel-Poisson junction conditions that you have to define at the boundary between this collapsing ball of matter inside your black hole and the de Sitter space that you get out of it. But it is possible to do. That's all I'm claiming. Sorry. What's the question?
You
would need a sufficiently large black hole to give you an inverse Hubble patch that could create our universe, but I don't think that's really a problem. And how large a black hole you need depends on how fast you're in photon. Whatever degree of freedom you identify that with is rolling down its patch after you've created this. Is rolling down its potential after you've created this.
Then don't we know what Hubble de Sitter is today? Because Hubble de Sitter is not being
arriving. So inside the black hole, you make this patch of some de Sitter space with different Hubbles.
But I think it's fair to say that roughly you should expect whatever the limiting curvature is to be roughly what Hubble was in de Sitter. What? Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
I don't understand.
Okay. Which part?
How do you get that universe?
You created a small inflating spacetime inside of the black hole. So it's the points between. The points between that patch of de Sitter space are the things that are inflating. And so it's perfectly fine to say that we're contained within a black hole. because the space is stretching inside that sort of area where collapse halted because of this maximum curvature hypothesis. It doesn't like, you know, consume the black hole or anything like that. No? Okay.
But now you're saying that the maximum curvature scale of our universe is of order Hubble, right?
Is of order Hubble during inflation. Yeah, so that is an interesting phenomenological avenue to run after. Okay, so the idea is if you ride along with that, then scalar fields can hop around vacua during inflation. This is something that's become well studied because people are thinking about the Higgs potential tunneling to large field values and going to an ADS minimum. So in the limit that the probability for tunneling is a bit small, and in a particular limit, you'd expect your tunneling to follow something like a Hawking-Moss instanton rate. And I'm just going to move a little bit quickly here. So the basic idea is if you have a moduli field, just considering one moduli field, the sort of limit that you would want to be in is that the curvature of your de Sitter space is a bit smaller than the height of your moduli barrier, and that can be used to ensure that variations are somewhat rare. Similarly, you could say that the VEV that you're sitting at right now is fairly large compared to the variations you expect when you actually do vary, and I would say that this would be the sort of simplest explicit model you could construct for cosmological natural selection. Right, if you wanted to. And again, I understand, you know, this is definitely a model that's been constructed to make the phenomenology of selected universes a little bit easier to do. So one last requirement you can make is that sort of the amount that you tunnel is a tiny amount compared to our cosmological constant. That way you're not tunneling to an ADS minimum. Okay. All right, so now I'm going to get into dark matter, pheno, and compact stars. So if you really disliked that, then I'm sorry, but we're moving on. So this talk will demonstrate that signatures of dark matter and compact stars, you could link that to something like the naturally selected universe that I just sketched out. To get to the question of how you actually measure this and evaluate this proposal, the naturally selected universe, the entropic version I'm going to advocate, is that you require most of what the universe does be directed towards self-reproduction, in this case, black hole production. So you want to require most of what the universe is doing to eventually give you black holes. Okay. So the question of what the universe does was addressed by Busso, Harnack, Cribbs, and Perez in 2006. They put it a little bit differently, but it is what the universe is doing. So most entropy increase in the universe comes from starlight, specifically electron volt energy photons rescattered to 20 MeV photons by dust. So that's where most of the entropy increase in our universe actually comes from.
We're not including any cosmological horizons.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so you exclude the de Sitter horizons and black hole horizons in order to make this statement. Yeah, that's right. That's a little ad hoc, admittedly. Yes. Subdominant entropy contributors include supernovae and active galactic nuclei. These are a few orders of magnitude down in terms of the entropy they're creating. Okay. The process here is hydrogen fusing to helium. You get 28 MeV of free energy, which all gets rescattered down to 20 millielectron volts. And you can plot the entropy production of the universe as a function of time. And it turns out there's this explosive period of stellar production and entropy production around 4 gigayears after the creation of the universe, or 4 billion years. And so briefly to reproduce the argument that Busso, Harnack, Cribbs, and Perez were advocating, they wanted to say that the causal entropic principle is that the maximum entropy production, which they wanted to link with observation, should occur at maximum co-moving horizon, which is causally connected space-time volume. Or in other words, they wanted to say, you know, we are observers, we should be in a universe that maximizes observation, so you should have maximum entropy production when the causal diamond of your space-time volume is largest. And indeed, this is in a way just a way to recast the cosmic coincidence problem, because the turning point between matter and dark energy domination, or rather matter radiation and dark energy domination, is around 4 billion years, and this period of peak star formation is around 4 billion years. This is not so mysterious. It's, you know, when galaxies are forming, you produce a lot of stars, and you sort of exit your matter-dominated era and enter a cosmological constant-dominated era, which means that your co-moving volume is going to get smaller as the cosmological constant takes over. And so this means that your space-time volume, the causally connected space-time volume, is decreasing. So if we had a greater or a smaller cosmological constant, we would not actually match this causal entropic principle. Okay. I would say the point here is that phrasing expectations of parameters in terms of entropy and energy to some extent can help sidestep the measure problem, or this ping-ponging back and forth. Because the idea is, if you formulate your principles applicable to in terms of just entropy and energy, then you should be able to, you know, evaluate any universe that obeys thermodynamic laws. And I think this is what Bucer, Harnack, Cribbs, and Perez were driving at. So on basic grounds, it shouldn't be so surprising that the entropic quantification, that just quantifying things in terms of entropy, simplifies the description of your complex parametric system. OK. Given all that, I'm now going to propose a measure for sort of a naturally selected universe based on just entropy and energy. And this is what, yes?
Is there a principal reason for excluding black hole entropy and things like that?
I can't think of an ironclad reason. I mean, it does have to be ad hoc. You do have to say that this isn't the sort of entropy that, you know, allows for, you know, things to interact or something like that. With this naturally selected universe hypothesis, you could maybe wiggle out of this, because forming black holes forms new universes, but you'll also get a peak roughly around where that cosmological constant peaks, because you'll have created these supermassive 10 to the 7 to 10 to the 9 black holes at around the same time that you're forming your galaxy after a few billion years. So actually the peak won't change too much. But yeah. Is that what you were wondering?
Yeah.
Okay, so what we would like to propose is entropic unification. So we require that at the time the source of maximum entropy in the universe, or halo baryonic matter, has grown to maximum complexity, the mass energy of the entropy source is more than half converted into new universes, in this case black holes. In other words, what the universe is doing is it's burning out stars. And if you really think that the universe's parameters were set to do something, that is create new universes, then you should expect that when whatever the universe is doing is done, or whenever you've reached this point where you've finished producing all this entropy that you're producing, then if you had a system whose parameters were set to do something, the end result of that really should be black holes. So just in terms of, you know, squiggle parameters, this is at the time at which the entropy of the sort of maximum entropy producer in your universe reaches its, you know, maximum, we just decided that half of its mass energy should be converted to black holes. Okay. What's that?
It doesn't count the entropy of the black holes.
Doesn't count the entropy of the black holes here, yeah.
And you don't count the sidereal energy, because black holes are also considerable here.
Right, so we're not including the entropy of the new universes that are created, yes.
Why?
Well, I mean, here I'm like in a space-time volume, and I can look around in that volume.
Like, mm-hmm. If you take the entropy of the star and you count it, and when it forms a black hole, it just disappears. And when, in fact, the entropy of the star is kind of maximized after it collapses. So it's just removing it from your space. This is what you're doing. This
entropy will go down.
I mean, entropy production will go down, yeah.
I mean, entropy itself, if you just ignore black hole, if you have a star with some entropy of stuff inside it, a lot of that stuff gets in your black hole, and now you don't count it anymore.
I see, yeah, sure. Yeah, sure. You're throwing it away inside the black hole. Okay, fine. And you're right, I guess global entropy would go up because of the black hole horizon, but yeah. But I think we've identified two categories here. So one is, you know, stuff outside of black holes, and one is stuff in black holes. And so in that sense, I think this is a consistent description. And that I have the mass energy of these stars burning, and I want, okay. So what's interesting with this is it sort of builds on this boutique cosmology scenario, and now you can predict the unmeasured constants of your theory by requiring that this actually happens. So clearly this doesn't happen in our universe, and I'll get into what exactly does happen in our universe, but you could think about adding new matter content or having dark matter parameters set so that you actually do achieve this, and that what the universe is actually burning out stars for is for the creation of black holes. All right, so an additional requirement is that this shouldn't just be some silly accident, so that the entropy expenditure of whatever is creating the most entropy in your universe actually is necessary for creating new universes, or in this case, black holes. So in other words, I shouldn't just be able to, you know, say, okay, there's some wacky coincidence, and when my stars burn out, I'm magically popping a bunch of De Sitter bubbles out of the vacuum. I should actually have had to burn out the stars in order to create the new universes. And this is what you would expect if the parameters of your system were actually tuned towards producing black holes, is that there's actually a point to the entropy release. So now we can start and ask just how good is the apparent universe at converting the maximum entropy producer, which is baryons and halos, to black holes? And the answer is not so great. So star masses follow an observationally fit spectrum. This is a Krupa IMF, or initial mass function for stars. And it ends up being weighted towards low mass or non-black hole producing stars. So 97% of your stellar mass ends up in main sequence stars and then becomes white dwarfs. 2% are core collapse supernovae that create neutron stars or thereabouts. That's the mass in the neutron stars. And about 0.1%, and that's being actually very generous, our core collapse of your mass is core collapse supernovae that ends up in black holes. So in the standard universe scenario, you're not actually that great at creating black holes. So if you want to know how quickly these stars are burning out or what the time scales are, more massive stars burn faster because they have deeper gravitational potentials. And this is where the 10 trillion years comes from, because the lightest main sequence stars take about 10 trillion years to burn out. Okay. So if I just plotted what standard black hole production looks like next to stellar production, I would just see graphically that they track each other, and I don't produce very much black holes out of baryons in the standard picture. So less than a thousandth of my final stellar mass ends up as black holes. However, we haven't measured all the halo parameters, and dark matter could increase black hole production. So now I get to the dark matter and stars pheno. So compact stars can be turned into black holes through asymmetric dark matter. So the process is that first dark matter is captured from the halo. So dark matter is flying around in the halo, and one dark matter particle scatters and becomes gravitationally bound to your compact star. That's the first step. The second step is that the dark matter and star reach thermal equilibrium after the dark matter is scattered around enough that it can form a ball at the center of the star, and it actually gets caught into the harmonic oscillator potential at the center of the star. Once enough dark matter collected, which happens around when the dark matter density matches the stellar density, the dark matter can self-gravitate and collapse in the star. And then two things can happen. One thing that can happen is that a large black hole can form as black hole composed of dark matter accretes the rest of the star. The other thing that can happen is that if you're inside of a star that has nuclei that could fuse to heavier nuclei and release energy, then dark matter collapse can ignite thermonuclear burning, the star can explode, the halo metallicity can increase, and that could actually lead to more efficient giant molecular gas cloud cooling. So this could actually also help create additional black holes or create black holes more efficiently.
You can improve the limits on the mass of the dark matter, right?
We're moving into the pheno section, and you can use all of these processes to bound asymmetric dark matter. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. LIGO, gravitational wave.
Yeah.
Protection.
Right. So.
They will tell us how many black holes are. Binary black holes. Most black holes are binary. So. They can tell you the rate of production of black holes from the data. Otherwise, how do we know
You're right in that, you know, when I showed the final mass function for black holes, I was giving a very rough estimate when I said 0.1% of stellar mass ends up in black holes. And we'll probably know a lot more in the near future once gravity wave studies have finished cataloging what actual What's that?
Where does this number come from now, observationally?
Observationally, this just comes from modeling 20 solar mass and above stars and looking for the distribution in your initial mass function of these very heavy stars, and then kind of extrapolating roughly to what you expect for the final black hole spectrum. It's rough, though, yeah. Okay, so in order to, the reason dark matter has to be asymmetric to some degree is that in order to implode in a compact star, the dark matter has to collect into a small enough core within the star and collect enough dark matter to self-gravitate. Even tiny self-annihilation cross-sections make this impossible, and hence the dark matter has to have some asymmetry so that some amount of it is collected into a tight core within the star that doesn't annihilate away. So there are a lot of different models of dark matter that implode in compact stars. One that we can rule out pretty quickly is if you just have a very straightforward GV mass asymmetric dark fermion model of dark matter, then you can tell without even doing a calculation that Fermi degeneracy pressure should stabilize up to a solar mass of dark matter, because Fermi degeneracy pressure can stabilize up to a solar mass of GV visible fermions, that is baryons. So this relies on the fact that even in 10 to the 13 years, at most something like 10 to the minus 9 solar masses of dark matter can accumulate in a compact star. So that model doesn't work. But if your dark matter is bosonic, then it doesn't experience Fermi degeneracy pressure. So bosonic dark matter without substantial repulsive self-interactions requires which requires a very small effective quartic self-coupling. This can collapse in compact stars, sort of within a giga year to 10 to the 13 year time scales. Another kind of dark matter that works is if you just have dark matter with attractive self-interactions, then the typical term you'd expect for Fermi repulsion can be canceled off by the attractive Yukawa interactions of the dark matter, and that can cause it to collapse. And the last option is just you make your dark matter extremely heavy. And if the dark matter is heavy enough, you can show that the critical number of fermions in a ball required for collapse scales like mass Planck cubed over mass of the fermion squared. So as you increase the mass of your fermion up to masses about PeV, then something like 10 to the minus 12 to 10 to the minus 14 solar masses of dark matter is enough to collapse and form a black hole inside a star.
So is it important for your argument that it's all dark matter, what if it's like whole dark matter axioms, but there's a time interaction that
does it? It would still meet the criteria I set. Maybe you'd be less convinced, but yeah, it would still seem to meet it as long as you do actually create all these black holes. And now we just need to go over an abridged timeline of galactic halos with and without compact star imploding dark matter. Okay, so after about a billion years, galaxies form. This is in the standard and in the non-standard scenario. In 3 billion years, roughly, you get peak star formation. So you're forming a ton of stars. You have a few black holes. After 10 to the 11 years, you end star formation. So most stars are formed, and there's not a lot of gas around. Almost no gas, actually. And then after 10 to the 13 years, all the low mass main sequence stars burn out and become cold helium white dwarfs. And the idea is you could think about a naturally selected dark matter model that in this time scale ends up collapsing all of these white dwarfs to black holes and all the halos. And you can think about the standard scenario. In the standard scenario, what happens is that in about 10 to the 20 years, you actually have all of your white dwarfs evaporating off of the galaxy. And this depends on the white dwarf deflection time and the relaxation time of the galaxy. And this actually takes something like 10 to the 19 and 10 to the 20 years for stars to just sort of blow off into the IGM. OK. So we can construct a really simple model to enforce entropic unification. So this is the entry production from starlight hitting dust extrapolated out to 10 to the 13 years. And you see that it's falling off. And the reason it's falling off is simply because 0.1 solar mass stars are burning out and becoming compact helium white dwarfs. This is sort of the standard mass black hole fraction of stellar material. The fraction of stellar material that ends up as black holes stays around 0.1%. And then if you have a particular model of dark matter such that you can create these cores and all these old white dwarfs, then you can collapse into small black holes and turn them all into black holes within the time scale necessary. So there's this implosive dark matter scenario that seems to fit the criterion. So in this example, we have asymmetric dark matter with a cross section between 10 to the minus 40 and 10 to the minus 42 centimeters squared. It has a mass around 30 PeV, and it's fermionic in this case, although it could be bosonic with order one self-couplings. There's a spread in the cross section because these models tend to change with the late time metallicities of the halos, and so it's not quite clear whether we should be thinking about helium or something like carbon, oxygen, or iron, even white dwarfs. But it should fall into that range. And now I'm moving on to signals of compact. Yeah.
But it looks like from this plot, the prediction is that we should live at 1 trillion years. Why are we there at 10 billion?
Oh, I mean, this isn't making a prediction for when we're around. This is making a prediction for what your universe should do in the future, or what your universe should do once it's expended all its entropy, if its parameters have been tuned to create black holes. So it's not
the reason even Raphael and company did that is to try to explain why we live in a universe that we do.
What's
the point of the measure, and we put up from the requirements? I don't understand if this is the point of this exercise. Even if I accept the initial assumptions, which to me are completely ad hoc. So why the prediction to this from this plot should be that we live at 1 trillion years?
I want to answer your question seriously. So I mean, if I look and I just look at where all the entropy in the co-moving volume lies, about a third of it actually lies between 10 to the 9 and 10 to the 10 years. About a third of it lies between 10 to the 10 and 10 to the 11, and a third of it lies in this region as well. And so if you just associate entropy expenditure with our existence, I think you're probably equally likely to live in either one of those three decades. But I'm not trying to make,
yeah. If you change the parameters by your own time, this can go, because this is so abstract, this is exponential.
Right, and that's actually what I like. Because what I'm trying to do is create, you know, a situation where you could actually test an anthropic idea with a really tight sort of prediction for what dark.
The idea is not even well-defined. Take a relation about the curvature that has a parameter completely at all, based on classical physics, and you're making assumptions about things that involve quantum mechanics.
Yeah, so I had.
So I don't understand how this constrains anything. I
guess what I'm saying is if you found dark matter that did this, maybe you could think that the universe might work this way.
Maybe it doesn't.
No, I mean, absolutely. I agree with that. And okay, but let me defend this measure a little bit, because I mean, I think maybe it gets a little bit more directly at what biological life forms do than the original criterion, which is that if you vary any of the parameters of your theory, you create more black holes. So the point here is that if you think about any life form, including bacteria, salmon, or humans, the point at which they stop producing entropy is roughly coincident with the time scale at which they reproduce. Or in other words, if you set a system of complex parameters such that you expect reproduction at the end of the sort of complex cycle of those parameters, then then that's basically what you get. That once your entropy reaches a maximum for any complex set of parameters, you do end up with reproduction. This is something that the biological world actually does roughly follow. So I mean, the timescales change across the different organisms for when entropy dies out and when reproduction dies out, but those two timescales end up being roughly similar. So that's actually where this is coming. Yeah. Okay.
I understand what graph I did with Ronnie.
Okay.
And so, graph, but I don't understand what is the point of this exercise. Because this is imposing one ad hoc principle on top of, in reality, what is also an ad hoc principle.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is what measures are. So you're combining, you're just making everything in fact worse. When it comes to the arguments that you were making in the beginning, if I start varying these parameters and parameter. Because I can easily see that this predicts that we should be, but 10 to 14 billion, 14 years, not 10 billion years. If you take your imposing one additional principle, that's not necessary at all.
I guess maybe we can talk more, but I don't understand why you think we would have to live at 10 trillion years.
Let's say, how do you falsify this?
Let's say that you will change the dark matter mass of the curve, but you have to grow exponentially, moves it into the right.
Sure.
In fact, you're maximizing entropy production because this goes up. It looks like natural selective dark matter keeps producing entropy all the way to 10 to the 14 and to the 15 years, the way it's drawn there.
Sure. So this is just the amount of mass that ends up in black holes. It's not,
Sure, but I don't understand. I can see this curve. Then why is this even relevant?
It's relevant because I'm saying, if your system of complex parameters is set up to reproduce, then you should expect reproduction to happen roughly on the time scale that it reaches maximum. Yeah.
Okay, so let me try and clarify one thing.
Okay.
You're plotting two different things on this plot, correct?
Yes.
The green curve is entropy production, the black curve is black hole production.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. So this is the mass fraction of stellar material contained in black holes. I'm sorry. Yeah, I should have said that and made that clear. That's my fault. This is why I've normalized the entropy per Coveney-Ming volume to a weird value. It's so that both of these will go from 0 to 1. What's that? Okay.
So everything that Raphael and those guys did is the same. Nothing changed in that part of the story. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
That's just adding one other thing.
Okay.
It's not changing that story whatsoever. It's just now it's saying that if we take this idea of cosmological natural selection seriously, then the shape of the entropy curve and the shape of that black hole curve should be related to something that Joe has pushed out.
So this is just a consistent.
It's not trying to answer the same question that.
Yeah, I agree. It's one additional principle here, right?
It's not an additional principle to answer the same question. It's just. What if we take this idea of cosmological natural selection seriously?
Yeah, but this has nothing to do with the green curve. This can move anywhere.
Oh, but I mean, I'm trying to make the argument that, this green curve tells you what your system was set up to do just by showing you where entropy production happens in your system. So if I have a complicated system that had if I have a salmon and it's tuned to reproduce, then it's going to run around in streams and in oceans and in all sorts of places, expending tons of entropy. But I should expect that at about the same time that it dies and it stops increasing the entropy of the system in a meaningful way, it's reproduced. Or otherwise, it's not a system that's been optimized for reproduction. That's basically what I'm trying to say. In this case, the system is stellar burning, and I'm saying that nature's parameters actually could be set to maximize black hole production in a way that mimics biological life, and you'd expect that maximization of black hole production to happen at about the same time that you stop producing entropy in whatever the maximum entropy producing part of your system is.
What is sigma nx?
Sigma nx is the that's the cross section for dark matter on a nucleon. So at very heavy masses like this,
It's being ruled out by Lux.
Not at this mass scale. Not at this mass scale. This is a mass scale far beyond even what Lux plots to. And at about 1 TeV.
How can you ever falsify this?
Actually, this parameter space will be falsified by xenon 1T and LZ in the next decade or two.
One term.
What's that?
one ton NOx is coming out.
Yeah. The 7 ton LZ, I think, yeah. Okay. So we're getting close to 1 hour. I'll talk about some interesting signals of dark matter and compact stars and halos. So these are possible signatures of this sort of scenario outside of the direct detection regime. So if you have dark matter and compact stars, you expect the capture rate of the dark matter on those stars to scale linearly with the density. That simply comes from the Bondi accretion rate of dark matter onto stars. So this tells you that because you have a dark matter density that rises at the center of galaxies, you get more dark matter captured in the center of galaxies. And you also get more dark matter captured in pulsars because they have smaller radii and slightly larger masses. And this gives you gravitational focusing. So this tells you that if you have dark matter of this property, and actually at this mass point, you can plot a prediction. Pulsars at the center of the galaxy should only reach a certain age before they collapse. And this is very rough because we've assumed that the pulsars stay where they're formed, but it gets the basic idea across. And right now, if you plotted all the pulsars we found from the AT&F pulsar catalog, this model isn't quite ruled out. But as searches continue for pulsars at the galactic center, largely motivated by the GV gamma ray excess, you could kind of rule out parameter space or maybe reveal an interesting signal if you have all your pulsars falling right below a curve. Right now, there's a very weakly significant missing pulsar problem at the galactic center. It may have just been astronomers a little bit more optimistic about how many pulsars they'd be able to see or how many pulsars would actually be at the galactic center, but you can kind of make hay with that as well. It's kind of interesting. Something I've worked on recently with Tim Linden as a signature of this implosive dark matter is a dark matter R process production. So if dark matter is causing neutron star implosions, there's perhaps an interesting link between dark matter abundance and the abundance of heavy metals in dwarf galaxies in the Milky Way. And here we have R process elements, which are heavy elements with peak abundances at atomic masses 80, 130, and 195. Formed in an as yet undetermined astrophysical site rich in free neutrons. So we actually don't know where certain heavy elements come from. Some examples of our process elements are gold and europium. So it's not quite clear what produces the majority of gold and europium. Two possible R process sites, the leading candidates, are neutrons ejected by a neutrino wind during core collapse supernovae. This would be an event that happens quite frequently. So here we have our core collapse supernovae ejecting a bunch of R process elements. You could have another possibility is merging neutron star binaries, tidally blowing off dense neutron fluid. So it turns out if you just take neutron fluid and you throw it out into the vacuum, or you throw it into this room, then just it's then as long as it's at a critical density of about 10 to the 12 grams per centimeters cubed, it will beta decay and turn into R process elements. And so assuming that R process elements come from neutron star mergers is a reasonable assumption, because as the neutron stars merge, you'll blow off quite a bit of neutron fluid and produce a lot of R process elements. So then another thing to consider is that if you had a black hole at the center of a neutron star and it rapidly accreted the neutron star, then in a fairly similar fashion to the tidal stripping you get when neutron stars merge, you should expect tidal stripping when neutron fluid falls into a black hole. In each case, neutron fluid beta decays and forms heavy neutron-rich elements. There's actually very interesting recent data as of December of this year about R process elements. So there are all these ultra-faint dwarf spheroidal galaxies, and these are galaxies that have a really high mass-to-light ratio. So they're very massive, so it seems like they contain a lot of dark matter and fewer stars. And these are very useful for stacking on top of each other for gamma ray constraints looking for dark matter annihilation. But another interesting thing about them is that one of 10 dwarfs, which is Reticulum 2, which actually has a very high mass-to-light ratio, has an anomalously high R process abundance, or this these heavy elements, which seem to be either made in supernovae, neutron star mergers, or maybe neutron star implosions. These heavy elements seem to be showing up in one dwarf, but not all the other dwarfs. So the gray dots here are stars in the Milky Way halo, and so you see that most of the stars have the R process metallicity exhibited by most of the dwarfs, but a few of the stars have a really high R process metallicity, including those in reticulum too.
The,
yeah.
These ultra faint dwarfs would be tiny strip.
What's that?
These ultra faint dwarfs could be tiny strip.
Sure. So you're saying they could have lost a bunch of stars from stars getting ripped off.
Close,
yeah.
Central of the galaxy at some point. So we're assuming that they're mirrorized objects.
Mm-hmm.
But they may not.
Right.
Maybe we should have a discussion afterwards.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good point. We don't quite know exactly how they were formed. Yeah, but we're going to talk about them anyway. Okay, so other dwarfs have low R process abundance. So what's really interesting about this to astrophysicists and specifically nuclear astrophysicists is that if you only have one UFD or ultra faint dwarf spheroidal with R process elements and nine without, this points towards very rare events. And so the people who had been banking on neutron star mergers are very happy about this because you should expect that you just get one dwarf spheroidal out of many that had neutron star mergers, and that should be very enriched. So something Tim Linden and I studied a little bit is how this merger would actually happen in a dwarf spheroidal and whether that's possible. And it seems maybe there's a slight problem. So in order to get neutron stars to merge very quickly, because the star formation in these ultra-faint dwarf spheroidals actually happen very quickly, you need a high eccentricity of your initial neutron star binary system. If you look at Milky Way neutron star R-process numbers, it looks like you need something like 10 to the minus 2 solar masses of R-process material produced from a merger every 10 to the 4 years, and that could explain the Milky Way's R-process abundance in terms of neutron star mergers. And so the required orbital eccentricity to merge within 10 to the 9 years actually tells you how fast you have to kick an initial neutron star that forms from a core collapse supernova so that it actually gets up to that high eccentricity. And it turns out you need it to kick at roughly 100 kilometers per second. But that would in turn kick the neutron star binary system to about 50 kilometers per second in the UFD rest frame. And merging neutron stars would not stay inside dwarf spheroidals if they actually got kicked up to 50 kilometers per second, because the exit velocity of dwarf spheroidals is actually only about 10 kilometers per second. So that's maybe an outstanding problem with the neutron star merger scenario. Of course, there are other things you can consider, which we also calculated, which is, what's the rate for a neutron star binary formed in the disk of the Milky Way to kind of just get flung into reticulum 2 and stuff like that. And those rates all seem to be a little bit too low to account for this. This is just the calculation. We don't have to look at it too much. And so the point is, if you just compare the rate that you would expect from neutron star mergers versus core collapse supernovae, then if you assume that the neutron star merger has to occur such that the initial kick velocity is 10 kilometers per second, you get a very, very low rate of these things forming, because it's very hard to form a neutron star binary system with a high eccentricity but a very low kick velocity. Similarly, you create far too many core collapse supernovae inside of all these dwarf spheroidals to account for this one R process event, but dark matter-induced neutron star explosions would roughly get it right. It's not to say that they do, but it's a possibility. So there are dark matter-induced neutron star implosions. You can do some fairly simple parametrics and show that all the neutron star fluid, as it falls into the black hole, crosses the Roche limit, which just means that it gets tidally squeezed more than self-gravity can handle, and you would expect some neutron star fluid ejected. This is something called the tube of toothpaste effect that Wheeler coined sometime in the 70s. The time scale for this sort of implosion would be about 1 millisecond, which is the same time scale for neutron star and black hole neutron star mergers. But what's interesting is even if you ignore the hypothesis that neutron star mergers, or that dark matter-induced neutron star implosions could create all your R-process elements, you can still possibly in the future use this mechanism to constrain not only dark matter that forms black holes in compact stars, but you could also constrain primordial black holes. And the reason is that on the y-axis here, we have, the y-axis here, we have a neutron star surrounded by a certain dark matter density, rho dark matter collapses in time tc. So as we go down here, it takes less time for these to collapse. So you can exclude some of the parameter space because we have old pulsars observed near Earth. But what's interesting is that there's a cool link here between Milky Way total metallicity and dark matter R-process production, or in the case of a primordial black hole entering a neutron star, you could have primordial black hole R-process production. So the black curve here roughly would match the R-process production in the Milky Way, but if you could show that a small black hole in a neutron star ejected something like more than 10 to the minus 4 or more than 10 to the minus 3 solar masses of neutron star fluid, you could start ruling out a lot of parameter space, both in terms of primordial black holes and asymmetric dark matter. Okay. And the last thing I'll go over really quickly is how dark matter of this character could ignite type 1a supernovae. So type 1a supernovae erupt when a portion of white dwarf becomes heated, igniting a thermonuclear fusion flame front that sweeps through the star, followed by an explosion. So you have an ignition phase, and then you have nuclei fusing up to 56 nickel, and then decaying back down to 56 iron. And these give you these light curves that follow what's called the Phillips relation, which tells you that there's a fixed relationship between the maximum luminosity of these curves and their width. So it's not quite clear what ignites type 1a supernovae. Candidates include binary accretion to critical mass, also known as Chandrasekhar mass, and white dwarfs merging. So white dwarfs could merge and then create type 1a supernovae, or you could have what is pretty much taught in undergrad textbooks, which is that you have a donor star which feeds enough material onto the white dwarf that it then explodes once it reaches Chandrasekhar mass. But lately, there are some problems with the Chandrasekhar scenario. The first is that if you had binary ignition, then once you start measuring the leading edge of supernova light curves, you expect to see small bumps from the shocks from that other star being in the system. And these small bumps here are simulated as the blue, green, and pink lines. We've now actually collected spectra of type 1As before they went off, and we're not seeing the bumps for the high mass donor stars that we might expect. The other problem, if you might believe in white dwarf mergers, is that it's not quite clear that those can match the high rate of type 1A supernova. These are actually known problems in the type 1A supernova literature. Furthermore, recent observations indicate that about half of type 1A supernova probably originate from sub-Chandrasekhar white dwarfs. So in other words, they don't actually reach 1.4 solar masses. This implies that probably subcritical white dwarfs are igniting. That could be through neutron star mergers. And the way that they determine this is by sort of carefully modeling how 56 nickel would decay and how the resulting cobalt on its way to decaying to iron would trap photons. And so actually, the curves that fall faster are from lower mass white dwarfs. And the idea is the light is getting out faster, and so your light curves are dropping off faster. OK, so the apparent existence of sub-Chandrasekhar supernovae prints a quandary for ignition by binary accretion, because that scenario told you that you should reach Chandrasekhar mass before exploding. And it doesn't seem like we're necessarily getting there. And so there's a sort of a relationship that's been derived between the mass ejected in supernovae and the initial solar mass and light curve stretch. So just from looking at light curve stretch, you can maybe extract how massive the original white dwarf was. And so it's interesting to consider whether dark matter could ignite white dwarfs. So in order to ignite a carbon-oxygen white dwarf, the dark matter, again, has to collect to the point of self-gravitation within about a billion years. And the principle is the same as the one described before. Again, We have capture rate that scales with the dark matter mass squared and the inverse of the dark matter radius. This means that more massive white dwarfs will collect faster for two reasons. One is because they have more scattering sites for the dark matter to collect on, and the other because they have smaller radii, which actually increases the capture rate. So white dwarfs get smaller as they get more massive because of they're supported by electron degeneracy pressure. Okay, so if you have a more massive white dwarf, then you should expect your dark matter to collapse sooner, both because it's collecting more quickly and because there's a slight enhancement in, well, you need slightly actually less dark matter to collapse because it'll get packed into a tighter ball because the more massive white dwarf is more dense. That's basically what's on the slide. All right, so what's interesting is that there's an unexplained correlation between the age of type 1a supernovae host galaxies and the type 1a light curve stretch. So this is separate data from the data relating light curve stretch to the masses of the type 1a supernovae progenitors. And so you can put these together, and you can get a prediction that there's a slight correlation between the initial mass of the type 1a supernovae progenitors and the age of their ignition in giga years. And it turns out that because of the dark matter accreting a bit faster in heavier white dwarfs and collapsing a little bit sooner in heavier white dwarfs, and vice versa for low mass white dwarfs, you can actually find fun model lines that roughly match this. But more directly, if you find out that dark matter is not igniting white dwarfs, you can start bounding this high mass dark matter parameter space by using the non-observation of old white dwarfs having been exploded by asymmetric dark matter. And so, conclusions. There could be some interesting dark matter signatures if the parameters of the universe have been set to maximize black hole production. But dark matter that collapses in compact stars within 10 giga years could be found by seeing imploding neutron stars, correlations of type 1a supernovae, and looking at R-process elemental abundances. Conversely, you can place pretty good constraints on dark matter and primordial black holes using the same astrophysical phenomena and processes. So that's it. Thank you.
Okay, so we had quite a lot of questions during the talk. So one or two, and then Joe's around.
So I want to understand. There seem to be very simple ways to satisfy your principles and end up in a universe that looks like nothing like our own. For example, you can imagine theories where there's 10 photons. That helps with entropy production, it helps with energy loss, so it enhances collapse, so it facilitates formation of compact objects like black holes. So it both helps with entropy and with black hole formation. Or, as we were saying before, you can increase the weak scale closer to the Planck scale, or you can increase delta rho by rho. So it seems to me you're not asking the questions of why doesn't it, isn't that the way our universe is.
I did think I was, in what I was doing, I was at least attempting to address these sorts of objections by saying we should stop trying to vary, all our parameters to figure out what the universe could be doing that, better matches, whatever our expectations are. Right, I have.
Adding interactions of the dark matter with us. So
you've broken
that.
Very simple conclusion of your two principles is that the standard model should be much, much richer. It would have billions of elementary particles and massless particles that contribute to entropy and collapse and black hole formation. So it seems to me if you take the principles at face value, you would reach a very different picture of what's the most likely universe.
Okay, I wouldn't say so only because at least as I thought I was defining it, the principle is simply that once the entropy, whatever is producing entropy in the universe that you're actually in, dies off, you should expect to get. I mean, it's really just that time scale. I was identifying with the time scale that you should produce tons of black holes. And all I was saying,
I didn't understand what you said.
Okay. So yeah, if I understand what you're saying I could think of a universe that's much simpler and produces black holes. What I'm saying is if, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, all of these are possibilities. Right. So, right. So our universe obviously isn't optimized for producing black holes, or you know we wouldn't be here, which I understand is a common problem and is a common anthropic dodge. But that's why that's why me and my collaborators were just trying to identify sort of a principle that should work in any universe where the parameters of the theory have been selected to create new universes. And the reason is just this. If you had parameters set to create complex processes in order to eventually create new universes, then the only thing I think you can really assume is that by the time those complex processes have reached maximum complexity, at that time you should have produced a lot of new universes if that's what those parameters were set up to do. So that's actually the whole criterion. In fact, I think it's kind of obvious the universe we're in isn't going to be optimal for producing the universe. Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No.
Can I be maximally generous to your idea? Let me try and sell this in a slightly different way that
Please.
will satisfy people in this room.
Sure.
All right, conditioning on everything we know about the universe. We know there's dark matter, we know there's one photon, we know all these things about our universe. We want to know if there's anything to this principle that Joe has introduced here. A prediction of this principle that Joe has introduced here is that the dark matter, which has an unknown structure of the dark sector, should be, if this principle is correct, such that at late times it makes tons of black holes.
Yeah.
And if we discover what the dark matter particle is, and that it is not a form that makes tons of black holes, then this principle is wrong.
Right.
Because this principle made a prediction for something we do not yet know that was incorrect. I think, in my opinion, the only utility of any of these measures is to make predictions for things we do not yet know, conditioning on what we do know right now.
Principles that are advocated seem to be violated by the matter, the standard model. So there are two parts, the standard model and the dark matter. You assume that you freeze all the parameters of the standard model and you vary only the dark matter.
You're being more ambitious. I'm being maximally generous, you're being maximally ambitious. I'm saying give up on the fact that this principle can explain every single parameter of the standard model and every parameter of the dark sector. Be maximally generous and just say, condition on everything we know and try and make a prediction for something we don't know.
Related to that, are there any predictions besides dark matter that you might expect that this sort of principle could give you?
Yeah, so I explored, I didn't want to do it this way. I didn't want to create universes inside black holes because that's crazy. So I was trying to think of ways that I could describe some sort of chameleon matter that slowly collects in stars. And so I can get like some sort of enhancement to Coleman-DeLucia tunneling or something like that at the late time of our universe or something like that. So you could think about something like that, that if the way you create new universes is through quantum tunneling, then maybe you can find fields that help do that by collecting in stars over time or something like that.
We know dark matter exists, but we also know that there are neutrino masses. We know that there's a strong CP problem.
Mm-hmm.
Does this principle help any of the models of strong CP or any of the models of neutrino mass make predictions for?
No, I don't think so. No.
What if we don't detect dark matter particles in the present universe?
What if we don't find dark matter in the present universe? Then, at least in this sort of explanatory schema, this would be falsified as well.
It's falsified. Maybe in 100 years.
Okay, so at that point, I think we should thank Joe again, and he is around for a couple of questions.
Thank you.